Okay, so first I want to say in terms of what my agenda is for tonight, and that is first off is to give very quickly sort of an analytical view of what the MOOC phenomena is all about. How many of you are actually familiar with the concept of MOOCs? Really? That means I can shape your minds in whatever way I want to. That's interesting. Okay. And so the evolution of MOOCs, and maybe then after I do this, since you're not familiar with that, is you'll understand the statement I make, a MOOC is not a MOOC is not a MOOC. That might make a little more sense, hopefully, you know, after I do a little description. And then I want to say something about the future of MOOCs, which is really a contested issue at this point in time in terms of education, online education, with particular emphasis on the future of MOOCs in higher education. And as I said here, you know, I'd like to make this interactive. If you have questions or comments as we go along, let's enjoy it. Okay, so first off, is that if you don't know what a MOOC is, this is the definition slide. It stands for Massive Online Open Course. And the idea behind this is that it is a course that is open, participatory, and connects students that are all interested in the same topic. But the key word is the way it does it, and in many ways the key word is massive, because of the scale in which it operates. And so that's why the second statement here is it gives a massive network of tools and people and educators from a lot of diverse, you know, areas, geographical areas, expertise areas, etc., to put them to get together. And another thing about MOOCs is that currently, at least in the States, and in Europe, it's attracted a great deal of potential due to the huge enrollments, like six-figure enrollments in some of these courses, and due to the fact that they've been involved with so-called elite institutions. So that's one of the reasons that it's attracted, the whole concept has attracted, you know, some attention, especially in the media. Okay? And in fact, what I always try to do to see about how well it's going to attract attention is if you do a search, a Google Analytics for MOOC, you'll really see that the real peak interest occurred just around 2012. At that particular point then, there was a lot of searches. Now, what's also interesting about this is it indicated that a large number of those searches came from Vietnam. And I don't have any idea why that's true. You know, what it is that the possibility of MOOCs in terms of Vietnam is a very interesting cultural question. Okay? So, couple of things in terms of the hype. You know, you'll see things like in this cat, the day of the MOOC. You know, it's a, you know, as created as some sort of monster that is somehow taking over distance online education. And if you're interesting right here, you'll see the day of the MOOC, it's disrupting everything. And, you know, it's a tsunami of poorly understood pedagogy. These are obviously people who are dubious about MOOCs. And connectivist unleashed a force that they cannot control. So the MOOC is a monster in some people's perspective, but the day of the MOOC. You've also got MOOC hysteria, something new in shock thriller education. You know, what is all this talk about MOOCs? There was recently in Tech and Learning magazine a survey about how have you tried a MOOC yet? And you'll see almost half the people responded, said, what's a MOOC? Other people basically said, no, I think they're a fad. No, but I plan to, etc. So it's really, you can say in that case, it's clearly not something. And then, of course, if you look at, try to create a word cloud associated, which always give you some sort of indication about what kind of social and metadata people are saying, you know, you come up with something like that. Okay, So a little bit in terms of a history and a background. Two educational theorists or pedagogists, Siemens and Downs, had the idea of connectivism in education, which basically says that knowledge is actually distributed across a collection of connections, and therefore learning could be accomplished by leveraging as much as you can the ability to traverse those connections. Okay, this is a little bit, quite a bit, as I should say, different from traditional education, because it gives the impression of being more peer-to-peer instead of top-down. So this is basically what the idea of connectivism came from. But of course, Downs had to prove this in some ways. So he decided to give a course on connectivism, and he decided to do it according to the theory. In other words, create a MOOC. Alright? And since then, so the notion is he designed MOOCs the way they did because if you think about it in the conventional lecturer-student model, the top-down model, it doesn't scale. It doesn't scale very well at all, even in terms of distance education. It becomes unmanageable. Where the notion, too, is if you really have strong connectivity between students, decentralized connectivity between students, it is capable of scaling. But at the same time, as you see, it sort of changes the role of each one of those participants. It changes the role of the student, and it also changes the role of the instructor, which is the revolutionary element. So the question was that came from this is how can we use technology to online to do what we can't do in class? You know, doing this, having that particular model, is clearly something that you do in class. And so rather than actually having online education simulate or emulate what you can do in a real-time environment, try to do something that is not possible to do in a traditional teaching environment. This idea of connectivism. All right? It's not making the best use of technology if all it's trying to do is copy something that has been successfully done for centuries. All right? And so the essential elements of a MOOC, according to this, is, first off, is there is this concept of autonomy. And this is pretty threatening to the whole idea of education, because the idea is that students can decide how much they want to participate. Secondly is diversity. Students could, in this particular model, given the technology, participate from just about anywhere. And they also will have wide diverse experiences. Openness means that it's free or so low cost that is effectively free. And last is interactivity. And the idea behind interactivity, according to the connectivist model, is that is in fact where a lot of the learning is going on, is by students interacting with other students. You know, forming such things as personal learning networks and personal groups. Okay? So this is fundamentally what's different from the idea of education that is presented in a MOOC. So, and the idea too is I think it goes back, the whole idea goes back a little bit further than that. A lot of it starts back before that MOOC by Downs and Siemens, but the idea too is I believe it really starts with this whole idea of MIT that had open courseware, where in fact MIT was talking about putting classes online. They perhaps were not connectivist, but they had the qualities of being able to be a part of a connectivist educational experience. I mentioned that first MOOC in 2008 at Manitoba. This was the connectivist MOOC that was done. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard of the Khan Academy, right? everyone familiar with the Khan Academy? The Khan Academy is interesting sort of in this case because we said, for example, that students have autonomy. And the real interesting thing about the Khan Academy is that people were able to take advantage of the educational content on YouTube. They were not following a particular course, but really all they were able to do then is go in, get what they needed, and then leave. So they had the freedom of participation. Okay? So if, for example, you needed to brush up on your trigonometry, then really all you have to do is just look at those courses in trigonometry on the Khan Academy. Since they were all dependent upon one another, you didn't necessarily need to have any of the prior courses to have prerequisites for those courses. And then you could stop whenever you wanted to. Okay? So that's pretty much the same idea. And these other ideas about what's happened in terms of these types of MOOCs were videos about MOOCs, sort of spread the idea. And then secondly was something that happened by Cormier, which basically was putting college prep material, helping students to study for the SAT or the GRE exams. So this was motivated by need that they were doing that in a far less formal structure than you might have in an otherwise teaching environment. Okay, the real poster child for MOOCs, you know, came in 2011, and that's at Stanford. It was a course on artificial intelligence that had 160,000 people register for that course. Now, that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous only in the sense that you would ask, how could that course possibly be manageable? How many TAs would an instructor need to handle a course that had 160,000 students? Okay? How would you do assessment for a course that had 160,000 students? How would you communicate with a course that had 160,000 students? But Harvard always has to be better than Stanford. The following year, they had a first MOOC that had more than a third of a million participants. Okay? So really, it showed that people saw the value, even though we might say the big question is that you've got 160,000 or 370,000 people who registered. The question is how many of them finished. Pardon? The Harvard, can't remember what the topic of the Harvard course was. I don't care about Harvard. Okay. In 2012, there was Coursera and Udacity, which were formed, which companies that were actually formed by computer science faculty at Stanford. And edX, which is a consortium, was formed. And they offered their first MOOCs on that platform. And I say here they offered XMOOCs. I'm going to explain to you what an XMOOC is. 2012, the New York Times calls 2012 the year of the MOOC. And then by the time we get to this year, there are more MOOCs, both XMOOCs and CMOOCs, than you can accurately count. All right, so the question then is, how can you decide whether or not MOOCs are really worth an investment? How do you decide whether or not they're a fad or, in fact, really a revolution in education? And so one of the things I did when I did this tutorial was sort of look at sort of common diffusion models in terms of what do you do with new technologies? What do you do with revolutionary technologies? How, in fact, do you decide whether or not they have lasting value? And one of the ones that I used was this idea of Rogers' S-curve, which some of you have probably seen. And it talks about diffusion rates over time. Basically, what it's looking at is the area under this bell-shaped curve. which effectively leads up to 100%, and it shows in this case the sequence of adoption or diffusion, how well things are adopted over the period of time. Well, someone took this concept and they applied it to MOOCs. And in fact, you could make the argument that MOOCs, in fact, follow somewhat of that kind of curve. So in other words, the notion, too, is if you believe that particular model, diffusion over time, it indicates that, in fact, it is a stabilizing technology. Some of the students that are in my class now are also familiar with this curve, which they know I like, is the whole idea of the Gartner hype cycle. And the notion, too, is that this talks about visibility over time. You know, just because something's getting a lot of hype and a lot of press, does that really mean it's something to be taken seriously? So you can, the expectation is that any many new technologies might, in fact, follow a curve that looked like this with respect to time, where basically there's lots of hype, lots of discussion, and then at this particular point, people realize, oh, well, you know, something else new comes along. Maybe it's not as great as it was. So that's what's called here. Then after that point, people start figuring, well, you know, it's not everything that it was here, but we can compromise and take something, at least some elements of it that are meaningful, and then it becomes productive. Now, this is a common methodology, as it were, for describing, as it were, the life cycle, as it were, with respect to time. Okay, someone actually did a MOOC hype cycle. And the suggestion is that right now we're getting ready to go into that trough of disillusionment. The suggestion is that really, in fact, that MOOCs have, in, you know, pretty much made the impression that they're going to make. They brought attention to this idea of a connectivist educational model. But are the downsides such that it really cannot ensure its future? Or the other thing is thinking about, what is this connectivist model or this MOOC model going to have on education, especially higher education? Because one criticism that we're going to talk about is that the connectivist or decentralized model in some ways is very threatening to faculty at universities. Because effectively it is saying they play less of a role as those that are providing instruction and more of a role of someone who is supervising a connected learning process. So that's very threatening to our ages-old model of how teaching and learning is supposed to occur. All right. Clearly, in this, it's a word that's bandied around a lot. And clearly, I think that one thing when you talk about MOOCs is that people use the term and they aren't really clear on what the concept is, if you think about it. Mainly, they think about it in terms of its size, not in terms of its execution, not in terms of what it's trying, in fact, to accomplish. Okay. So there's been, you know, a couple of redefinitions. Mark Stanford, or Sanders, I'm sorry, at Stanford has said that it shouldn't be MOOC, that it should be MOD-MCCRS. I don't know how to pronounce that. But basically, it's a massive, open, digitally mediated, course-compatible resources. In other words, once again, resources that are compatible with other courses, once again, like the Khan Academy, that you're in fact then able to mediate or integrate into existing courses. And that's true. That is certainly true. And we'll talk about a model for doing that. And then the other notion, too, is that MOOCs are a symptom of learner-initiated learning. And the idea, too, that bring your own device, then, given then that people have lots of devices and ability to get on the network, has in fact motivated, or at least shown a greater interest in people trying to use MOOCs. So when it talks about learner-initiated learning, it means effectively what's referred to is learning at the speed of need. Just like we said about the Khan Academy, when you need something, you can jump in and learn it, and then you can jump out. BYOD means that basically any place has the potential of being a learning environment. So, you know, you could watch your course in trigonometry in the back of a taxi. And that becomes a learning environment, a learner-motivated and initiated environment. Okay, a little more history quickly about this. I mentioned the fact that I really think that the notion, a lot of what happens as far as MOOCs, goes back into this open university and open educational resources model. So what we have here, so this is like the open university in the UK, and certainly there's the open university in Hong Kong, whose goal then is to provide resources, and they actually have wound up graduating, both of these universities, huge numbers of students. Very respectable sizes of students have proved that education and credentialing in open universities works, or can work. Right? So the Open University of the UK, which has no academic admission requirements, has awarded over 1 million highly regarded degrees to its students. Has HKU had 1 million graduates?
We had 100 years.
Huh?
10,000.
So, but the notion with the trick here is that entry to an open university, we can say, is easy. Exit is hard. It's easy to get in, but it's hard to finish. Once again, this goes back to the idea that taking advantage of that model is for the motivated learners. Okay, so here we mentioned this in terms of that, is that open resources then allow students to come up with a wide variety of content and something that's more diverse than what an individual instructor might be providing. You know, so when an instructor teaches a course, they make a decision about what topics they're going to cover. Whereas in an open university, the student can decide the curriculum, still within the guidelines that might be provided by the open university. Okay, now this next particular point, because this is the point where we talked about Downs and Siemens having their connectivist model, and now I'm going to say that connectivist model is what can be referred to as a CMOOC, C for connectivist. But around this period of time is when you really had a divergence or bifurcation in this idea of MOOCs. Because about that time is when you had Thrun's AI MOOC at Stanford, and the idea there, it was an XMOOC. Now what an XMOOC basically says, it is in fact more compatible with traditional instruction. Traditional instruction in the context of a university, and less perhaps on that connectivist model. Okay, this is just a slide I had that was talking about OER. Some of you are not familiar with that. So, here's the idea of thinking about XMOOCs versus CMOOCs. Clearly, all these ideas, too, have to do with the concept of MOOCs, like what is massive? That's an arbitrary thing. Open registration, local cohorts. a number of MOOCs, even though they may have students that are spread all over the world, often have meetups, you know, in certain geographical areas, once again, to create learning experiences. And these other aspects, the role of the instructor, college credit, you know, assessment, affordability, open content, etc. So all of these actually then defines the difference between ex-MOOCs and C-MOOCs, where ex-MOOCs have a focus on scalability in terms of size, and C-MOOCs have more of the focus on building these learning communities, more of that connectivist model. And it's important to make those distinctions, right? Because we can certainly see now these two types of MOOCs going in very interestingly different directions. Okay, so here's two comments I like. I'm a big fan of Ivan Illich, you know, in terms of educational theory. And of course, you look back in 1971, he was talking about online education ideas that he didn't have the technology to implement. But certainly now we have come up with the technology that you can. So, you know, here's basically what he's saying is the educational system should provide all who want to learn with the availability of resources. Hey, that sounds like these open educational models, right? Or the other interesting thing that he says, and this is what I had in part of the tutorial, it effectively also says that an educational system is once again going to be decentralized in the sense that if there is something you want to teach, you should have the mechanism to be able to teach it, right? To see if people are interested in it, right? So that changes who the role of the teacher might be. The other quote that I put in this particular case is MOOCs are attracting media attention. They are at the intersection of Wall Street and Silicon Valley. What does that mean? Well, effectively, those two things are saying that at the beginning is what we can think about in terms of C-MOOCs, and this is X-MOOCs. Because we talked about Coursera and Udacity and those, clearly a lot of those goals are going to be to monetize education. Now, an interesting thing to me about that, in some ways, is that many universities, and certainly instructors, professors at universities, used to have, or still have, you know, very demeaning attitudes towards some of the commercial organizations that provide education. In the States, for example, there's the University of Phoenix. I don't know, are they in Hong Kong? Which basically then are pay for education and value. Okay? There's been lots of discussion about those, and certainly they've actually been the proof that some of these institutions, you know, are doing illegal things. Okay? And that they were in it only for profit. But the ex-MOOCs people, in the same way now, are adopting that same concept where that education, no matter where it comes from, you know, could in fact be more widely available and satisfy people's particular needs. Okay, so I'm not going to go through this chart. Once again, if people want to have a copy of these slides or the whole tutorial, the main things that we would look like here, the difference, what we said, between what is the ultimate goal. For ex-MOOCs, we can say it is to efficiently deliver content to large audiences, to do accreditation, okay, to experiment with new courses that are outside the university structure, but could, in fact, at a later time, become incorporated into the university structure. For C, oh, and the last part of this, of course, is that basically it says, and you look at this in terms of making money, you too can have a course from a elite institution. This is an issue too. You know, this is going to start, as it were, a categorization, as we were, of institutions. Who's elite and who's not? And what value does it have to a student to be able to take a course from an instructor at an elite institution, not live, but remotely as a MOOC? In the case of a CMOOC, if you look at the goal, is to foster connections and collaborations among learners. And to, in fact, in that case, create communities, possibly communities that could go on. Now, in some ways, you look at that and ask yourself, isn't that really one of the more fundamental goals of education? You know, to build communities, to build networks, to demonstrate how you can, in fact, learn or use the content that you learn. But throwing something in here with respect as this concept of a blended MOOC. And this, some of you may have heard the term flipped classroom. And in this way, things like MOOCs or the Khan Academy have been successfully used in the concept of a flipped classroom. So suppose the model was, instead of going to a university and having a lecturer teach you a course, then in fact what you did is you went online, watched the course material by means of a MOOC or something like the Khan Academy, and then when you did go to class, you discussed the content that you saw in the MOOC, right? So it flips the notion of where the learning occurs. The controversial thing about the flipped classroom, we say here, is that it can change the role of the instructor. So someone who has worked very hard to be a professor doesn't just want to be a babysitter for students that are learning this topic and to mediate a discussion about this topic. They want to be doing the teaching. They want to have control of the teaching. The other nice thing about blended MOOCs is it simplifies assessment. So once again, you know, it does have the advantage that perhaps, but does a professor only want to be around because they can grade work? All right, so this is one notion of a blended MOOC, and this is in fact happening, especially like in the case of the Khan Academy, where you can see that a lot of schools are then requiring students in math to watch tutorials on Khan and then come to class and discuss that content, maybe work some problems, answer some questions, do some assessment, but the teaching goes on outside of class watching the videos on the Khan Academy. Okay, so the question is, are MOOCs just a fad? Who do they benefit? Do they benefit the students or do they benefit an institution? Can they remain free? And how do you choose between CMOOCs and XMOOCs? Well, here's the common pros and cons. The advantage is that they're free unless you want college credit. So unless you want something more than a piece of paper that says you completed this MOOC, can you apply it towards a degree program? That brings up a whole new issue, especially if it's free. That's going to be very jeopardizing toward the monetization of education. Another advantage, we said, is that learning is informal and at the student's own pace, motivated learners. The only resources you need are connectivity, Students can share work, assess others, and receive feedback from others. Once again, this connectivist learning process. And then world-class instructors without the high tuition of elite institutions. Right? So you can learn artificial intelligence from a professor at Stanford. Right? Even if you are matriculated in some other school. That's another threatening part, too, because in some ways, is it asking the question then, is if we can do that with MOOCs, right, in a distributed way, then isn't that going to create a separation in terms of instructors? So, for example, Sebastian Thrun's course in artificial intelligence, if you have access to that as a MOOC, right, what is that going to do for other professors who teach courses in artificial intelligence? Right? If you can get it from someone who is recognized as a world-class authority, it then, in fact, might demean the role of professors at other institutions. Especially if you can get credit. Okay, cons? Ex-MOOCs involve costs, sometimes significant. Now, there's an interesting thing that's happening there with respect to cost. And this is what I mentioned about what Udacity and Coursera do. Because in many ways, these costs are not a part of the learning process, but in a way in which to monetize some of the connected or associated things from the learning process. For example, means for recruitment, those kinds of things. No real-time engagement, right? Suppose you have technical difficulties, academic dishonesty is possible, and students must learn to be responsible for their own learning. They have to be motivated. So that's one of the things that really is one of the major arguments that a lot of people have about the MOOC model. Okay, so once again, this idea from Ivan Illich is that you need to empower all who want to share what they know to find those who want to learn it from them. And I had this in here because this concept, this connectivist concept, I believe really gives or provides the vehicle, the platform, where anybody can be a teacher and anybody can be a learner as long as they're motivated. And the question is, do MOOCs really make this possible? Is it possible to experiment with the MOOC world? This was one of the things I did in the tutorial, but I have a little bit of that in there. So, for example, not to be left behind, Google has gotten into the MOOC business. And guess what? It has what's called Google Course Builder. This means that anybody can create a MOOC. You have to know a little technical details. And Google will host it for you. So if you want to teach on some obscure topic, and you've got the whole world as your possible audience, then you could use Google Course Builder. You don't pay a license. It's free. But why is Google interested in it? It's not completely free. For two reasons. One is that if you get too many students, you get 10,000 signed up for your MOOC. After a certain level, Google wants a commission. The other thing that they've done is they've closely tied Course Builder with all of the applications that are in Google Apps, which is fine because we talked about the connectivity. So being able to use Google Plus, being able to use YouTube, being able to use Picasa, all of those Google Docs, all of those elements can then be repurposed in this environment to create a learning experience. So in fact, in that case, you know, anyone could in fact create a MOOC according to this particular model. And this is just an example of those parts of the community component that you see in XMOOCs that could be accomplished using Google Course Builder. Okay, now, once again, XMOOCs initiatives, I know you can't read that, but you know, some of the things, once again, I would say that really are comparable to XMOOCs that have been around, and maybe you didn't categorize them or think about them in terms of MOOCs. You know, like, for example, iTunes University. Right now, you can look at Stanford courses on iTunes University. They're for people that are motivated. There's not necessarily any correlation between the courses. It's like MIT courseware, those kinds of things. Okay? TED has presentations. You can think about them in the context of a MOOC. But the point being is there's all these tools out here that are in fact related, but related once again like XMOOCs in the sense that they don't make the presumption that it's going to be decentralized. You still have to have a coordinating body with respect to these. The most popular ones we see are Coursera and Udacity. And there's a difference between these two. And both of these came out of Stanford, monetized by Stanford. But interestingly enough, Stanford MOOCs, I want to be teaching a MOOC in spring. Stanford MOOCs don't use either Udacity or Coursera. They use edX, which is the consortium that was started by MIT and Harvard, to which Hong Kong U has joined. Okay? Basically, the notion then is it makes it an open source platform for the development and execution of MOOCs. What does that mean for Coursera and Udacity? Well, there's other people that need education. There's other platforms for education, which we'll talk about in just a second. Okay, I want to quickly talk about in terms of a framework. There's an interesting learning framework that was done by Roy P. at Stanford. You know, in terms of designing and the evaluation of MOOCs. First off is this idea of learner background and intentions. We say that MOOCs are really going to be designed for motivated students. Okay? Students that are going to be highly engaged. And also some work is done really to sort of classify what these learners look like in MOOCs. Completing learners. Those who really try to do the majority of the work. One criticism that some people have of MOOCs is they have a very low completion rate. Very often less than 10%. But still, if you're talking about 10% of a third of a million, that's more students than I'm ever going to have complete a course of mine. Okay? Auditing learners. Still, once again, people who in fact drop in, look at the content. Disengaging learners might start the course and finish. Sampling learners and no-shows. Now, what's interesting about this is that perhaps in a traditional course, you would never think about categorizing learners in this way. You've either got people that are in it, drop out and lose their money, right? It's far more binary than the possibilities for students that might exist in MOOCs. There's this notion of technology infrastructure. We talked about in terms of those. How do you use technology to accomplish those characteristics of connectivism? You know, social media is clearly, this is a social network. Learning becomes a social network for a particular MOOC. Students interact with each other. And you collect data on those interactions. Okay? And so, for example, here's what someone did in terms of available tools to accomplish these things according to the very familiar Bloom's taxonomy, creating, evaluating, analyzing, applying, understanding, and remembering. How you can take these kinds of tools and apply them within a MOOC environment. Okay, and the last one is evidence-based improvement. How do you, in fact, you determine the success or the assessment? How can you be assured? This is going to clearly be a big one, especially if you want to give some kind of accreditation. And an interesting thing here with respect to that. Some of you might have read about it happened in San Jose State. San Jose State in San Jose, California, wanted to do an experiment to see whether poorly performing students in math would do better in a MOOC environment as opposed to a classroom environment. And it says here, and they use Udacity, they said it says here that online ed experiments dismal outcome. That's what you saw in the press about this. But then what I like is this statement. There were also problems with course design and deadlines in the university experiment. Once again, problems that other institutions will have to face. What I see interesting about that statement, is there any course, be it online or not, that if it has poor course design and execution and deadlines, it's going to work. So why is that unique to the MOOC concept? You still have to put together. MOOC is not going to be an easy way to get out of the design of a course. So what this says is talking about how do you do that level of assessment. Okay, one great potential that I think that you have for MOOCs or the MOOC concepts has to do with professional development. And this example that I have right here is the way that SAP, which is a major technology company, is actually using the MOOC concept to do industrial training. So in this way, what you see the MOOC concept has done has replaced, as it were, the concept like webinars that might have been used in the past for pushing out education. It also, once again, stimulates collaboration between the students in these professional courses. And if you look here, you can see that, sure, it had a large number that dropped out. But then it had a very interesting and very significant number who were motivated, clearly because they had a job, who were motivated to do the completion and to do it on their own terms. Okay, so in terms of my conclusions, in terms of this, I think that MOOC hype cycle is overly pessimistic in terms of where MOOCs are right now and in terms of the impact that they might have. And what I think perhaps is more important than anything else is the discussion, the whole discussion that the subject of MOOCs has initiated. Because, as I said, I think that it has brought a lot of attention to the notion of open education resources and how they could be used, possibly incorporated into curricula. There are alternative strategies to address the rising costs of higher education. Educational costs are ridiculous. I don't know what it's like here, but you know, the whole one big discussion in the States is, you know, is the notion of the level of student loans that students have to have by the time they finish their education. And what can they possibly show for that? So we mention learning at the speed of need. One thing else has come in this is the resources for continuing education. Once the notion is that access to learning can be anywhere on the planet through a wide variety of devices. And the notion, too, of crowdsourcing education. What does that mean? That basically says these learning groups, you're learning from a crowd. You're learning because of your interaction with people. It's decentralized in the same way. So what I think is going to happen is that we're still going to see the evolution of different flavors of MOOCs, not just C MOOCs and X MOOCs or blended MOOCs. You're going to see new business models come up around MOOCs, the way to monetize education. And I think that many educational institutions are going to start adopting MOOCs for one way, for one reason or another. Either local MOOCs, rather than, don't have to be public MOOCs with that concept, or like the flipped classroom models. And the question, too, is what I like to think, and this is one topic that really interests me, is MOOC for the masses. And what does that mean? That basically, the notion is that, you know, at the beginning of the web, if you wanted to have a web page, you had to be a techie. You had to know what HTML was. You had to know all those technical details. But what we've seen now, clearly, is we've got tools where you don't have to worry about those anymore. Anybody can have a blog, whether they're non-techie, whether they're techie or not, and all they have to focus on is the content. They don't have to worry about the technical details. So I would like to see an easy mechanism where something like WordPress that allows you to create blogs could make it easy for someone, in fact, to establish an educational presence. You know? And it can be self-governing in the same way that Wikipedia is. You can say, well, do people know what they're talking about when they have this course? Well, the people always know what they're talking about when they put something in Wikipedia, but the crowd decides whether or not it has value. But it's taking advantage of collective intelligence to diverge on something that is truly meaningful. Okay? What needs to be addressed in terms of this is the impact on faculty. Institutional investment in free MOOCs. Stanford has the notion that if you teach a MOOC and it's successful, it's going to provide you with good experience and feedback for teaching a regular course. So rather than experimenting with a course that might not be successful, the MOOC provides a sandbox where you can see what kind of reactions not only occur on the content, but on the instructor. Registration fee models, academic credit, robustness of assessment techniques. We haven't talked about those, but clearly assessment for large-scale, massive courses is a major issue. Copyright and licensing issues, just like you see in all those. Who owns this content? Archiving, security and privacy, and technology requirements. All of these, they're all familiar technology questions. We've seen those things before for a lot of other technologies, so they're not. These aren't unique to MOOCs, but they're clearly issues that still have to be addressed with MOOCs. But meanwhile, the number of MOOCs continues to grow. I say. MOOCs are in the news. Like, for example, Blackboard's one of the most commonly used LMSs, learning management systems, around. Blackboard has decided, it, you know, this is not for profit. It costs money to become, you know, to be a licensee of Blackboard. Okay? So when Blackboard decides to get into the MOOC market, it's because they feel as though either it's a threat or it's a way in which they can supplement their income. There's a bill that's happening in California right now where basically it says is if you take a course from any public university, be it by MOOC or otherwise, you are entitled to academic credit from that university. This is pretty heavy. This is something that Stanford doesn't want. Because once again, they feel as though that's going to reduce the cost of someone getting a piece of paper that says they took a course at Stanford. This is an interesting notion, too, about teaching journalism skills as an example of MOOCs. Okay, now here's one that I think is interesting. This is my summary point with respect to the future of MOOCs. Are any of you, Francis, are you familiar with Kaggle? Kaggle is a site for people to do predictive modeling, for data scientists. In other words, what Kaggle will do is they will post huge data sets and ask questions of people about how to mine those data sets for interesting information. And they have prizes. You know, for example, here's a data set that was posted by General Electric. You can win $250,000. That's pretty motivating, right? For anybody. That's U.S. dollars. That's not Hong Kong dollars. Okay. And Kaggle has a scoreboard. That's one of the ways they do their assessment, is if you participate in these Kaggle things, they keep a list of, you know, the top guys, just like a game. All right? What does that got to do with MOOCs? The interesting thing is, I say here, what do all the people on the leaderboard have in common? It's not an Ivy League education or a PhD in statistics. Most of the winners have taken Andrew Ng's data science course as a MOOC. That's where they learned about data science. They don't have degrees in it. They went on this MOOC. They learned data science. They were motivated. And that's the way they got on these leaderboards in Kaggle. Learning at the speed of need. Now, think again. If you're on this leaderboard because you've been able to successfully do these data science projects, and there's a company out there that wants to hire data scientists, are they going to care if you have a degree? They can see by this that you have proven that you know how to do the work. Right? So the question you ask here is this a new model for higher education? It wasn't the degree, it's the expertise that's important. It's the proven expertise that's important. So, what is the potential of MOOCs? Traditional versus modern. the university versus anywhere's a classroom. Learning anywhere, anytime, as needed. Potential of MOOCs, from institutional-based credentialing to activity-based reputation like Kaggle. So is there a revolution going on with respect to education? MOOCs would certainly suggest that there are. That there is, rather. Is it threatening? Yes. Is it disruptive? Yes. Is it a fad? I don't think so. Is it going to dramatically change higher education? Don't know yet. Thank you, everybody.